Will President Trump be impeached? Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the president now faces an impeachment inquiry, what that means for 2020 and Florida. We want your calls. It's 549-2937. Then later, Florida families speak out about proposed changes to the state's Medicaid waiver program. We'll tell you about their concerns. But first this morning, Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the House of Representatives will initiate a formal impeachment inquiry against President Trump. After months of resisting calls in her caucus for impeachment, Pelosi finally made her move last night in response to growing revelations that Trump allegedly sought to enlist a foreign power, Ukraine, to get dirt on a political rival, Joe Biden. Dr. Michael Binder is UNF's Associate Director of Political Science and has some thoughts about this. No surprise. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Let us know your reactions to the beginning impeachment inquiry against President Trump. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Already getting your Facebook comments, too. Okay, Mike, Democrats have been calling for this for many months now. The speaker has resisted. Let's explain what it is about these new allegations that seems to have changed the calculus.
Well, the biggest thing from Pelosi's perspective is moderates in her caucus. Those Democrats that are maybe recently elected, maybe in Trump districts or in moderate districts, they were the ones that were more hesitant and didn't want to go down the impeachment road. They have now come around in the last several days and are on board with this based on these latest accusations and understanding that Trump was enlisting Ukraine's help to get dirt on Biden and holding over their heads, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in foreign aid. And that's really what's changed in the last week.
Right. Moderate Democrat Al Lawson, a Jacksonville congressman, when he appeared on this program earlier this summer, was one of those moderates that you just referenced saying, I'm not in support of this at this time.
Moderate Democrat.
Right. And so, but now the ground seems to be moving. Now, the president will become one of only a handful of presidents to face impeachment. This is the most serious remedy the Congress has for addressing allegations of abuse of power. Andrew Johnson in 1868, Bill Clinton in 1998. Of course, Nixon resigned before he could be fully impeached. What are the politics of this, do you think? And in particular here in Florida, which will be, of course, a hugely contested state in the 2020 election.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of things to think about. One is from the Democrats' perspective, their base is just, this is in a lot of ways the last straw. And it pushed Pelosi to this point. And we're a few steps away from impeachment, right? There's going to be a series of investigations across a number of different committees. Ultimately, the House Judiciary Committee is going to have to vote. Again, these are Democrat-dominated committees. You would expect that in the coming weeks that will happen. Then it would go to the full House, again, Democrat-led body. At that point, things become tricky because it has to go to the Senate for a vote. And obviously, the Senate is led by Republicans, but you need two-thirds of the Senate. You need 67 votes. So you don't need one or two Republicans. You need couple dozen Republicans to go along. And that's going to be the real rub if we get that far.
And the Senate, which is held by the Republicans, what motivation would senators on the GOP side have to convict this president? Not much.
Not much, unless public opinion changes. And you saw that, you alluded to Nixon a little bit. That's where it happened with Nixon. Republicans began to bleed away from Nixon. Currently, Trump's approval rating is, you know, in the upper 80s amongst Republicans. If it stays there, there's no incentive for Republican senators to vote to impeach and remove him. But if that drops down to maybe the 50s or the high 40s amongst Republicans, and then you have all the Democrats and independents in opposition to Trump, suddenly the political calculus changes dramatically. And that's an opportunity where senators say, wow, I need to get reelected myself. Maybe I need to think about this.
This could be a fast shifting environment then. And we want your calls. It's 549-2937 as we speak with UNF political pollster Mike Binder. What's your reaction to news that President Trump is now facing an impeachment inquiry? Let's talk about the whistleblower. What to make of this news that whoever this person is now prepared to testify before a congressional committee about these allegations? that the president pressured the president of Ukraine to open a corruption investigation into former VP Joe Biden, his political rival. The whistleblower complaint alleges that the Trump administration was withholding funds to Ukraine that were congressionally approved, more than $391 million in aid. So the allegation flows along extortion lines, essentially.
Right.
And so President Trump says he'll release the transcript of the phone call he had with the president of Ukraine. The whistleblower is also prepared to testify.
And so I think there's an interesting thing to think about here is oftentimes these phone calls aren't recorded with foreign leaders. They're just often listened to by members of the National Security Council or team. So sometimes these transcripts aren't actually verbatim transcripts like you would see on a printout, for example, of your show. And you look at the transcript, it's word for word what we say. Oftentimes it's a summary of the main points of the conversation. So it's not entirely clear what this transcript actually will look like. So in a lot of ways, hearing from the whistleblower and their direct testimony might be more influential and might be more informative than perhaps a transcript of this case.
And Mike, let me read you a statement from Dean Black, chairman of the Republican Party of Duval County. He said last night, first, the Democrats subjected President Trump to an endless series of fake scandals. Now they will subject him to a fake impeachment inquiry. The outrage of American voters will not be fake. Americans have had it with a Democrat Party that has been hijacked by radical leftists bent on obstructing our president. Under Pelosi's leadership, the Democrats appear to be engineering a Donald Trump landslide victory. We look forward to Election Day 2020.
Well, Election Day 2020 is a long way away. And who knows? Mike Pence might be on the ballot in 2020. There is a lot that can happen between now and then. And that's, from one side, this is very similar to what Democrats were saying in 1998 when Republicans impeached Clinton. There's, this is nothing. This is no big deal. This is not important. The voters will say, and the voters did support Democrats both in the midterms and election in 98, and that helped them. I don't know how this is going to play out. We don't know what these revelations are going to be. And
whether even the vice president is implicated.
Or not.
And
there's a lot of members of the cabinet that are potentially involved in this as well. So there's a lot that's going to happen that we don't just know about yet.
Leo is in East Arlington. Hi, Leo. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to comment that a lot of people don't want to carry through the impeachment because the point, as your commentators have said, is that it probably will not pass the Senate. But I think from a larger perspective is we as an American people have to pass judgment on what this president has done, and we decide whether this is tolerable, this type of behavior or misbehavior, and it'll carry through in the reelection process. So I think the Democrats owe it to the American people, to the word of the Constitution, to put this president on a pedestal of judgment and pass that judgment and let the American people decide.
Leo, thanks for that. Dave is along I-95 southbound. Hi, Dave, out there on the road. What are your thoughts?
Yes, indeed. Thanks for taking my call. My initial reaction after hearing this was it's about time. The fact that the only reason why he wasn't indicted, according to the Mueller report, was that they have a policy, not a law, not any kind of statute, but a policy not to indict a sitting president, despite the fact that we know that he engaged in multiple acts of obstruction of justice, as well as coordination with a foreign entity in order to acquire elected office.
Dave, thanks for that. To be clear, that was alleged, not proven beyond a reasonable doubt, but I appreciate you bringing that up. The Mueller report, Mike, that is likely not to come up much in these new discussions, although for many voters out there, they saw it as evidence of obstruction of justice and corruption.
And it's also something to think about. These impeachment proceedings, as they are started, are not limited to what happened with the conversation with the Ukrainian president. This is when the House Judiciary Committee puts together their articles for impeachment. They can go back to anything. And I would fully expect potentially emoluments clause violations potentially to be in there. Things that were in the Mueller report could potentially be in there
as well.
You think
they'll revive that?
I certainly think it's possible.
Lots of comments on our Facebook page. Mike writes, even if disloyalty and obstruction of justice are not impeachable offenses, a lack of common decency should be, he says. Here's an email from Andy. There is nothing Trump could possibly do to alienate his Republican base. While I find this sad, I am just glad he decided not to shoot anyone on Fifth Avenue. That's a reference to the president saying, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and people would still vote for me.
We'll see. So far, that statement is rung true. He has been able to maintain his base support, and it's been a very narrow but steady base of support for the last several couple of years now.
Reynaldo is on the South Side. Reynaldo, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I love the show. I just wanted to provide some context so people know how serious a violation it is that President Trump did withhold military aid from Ukraine. Ukraine once had the world's third largest stockpile of nuclear weapons. And about a generation ago, it gave those nuclear weapons to Russia in exchange for security guarantees from Russia and the United States. So fast forward a generation, Russia is or has launched what looks like a destabilization effort in Ukraine that Ukraine is very vulnerable to. And if the president is withholding American military aid, that just illustrates how huge of a problem this is.
Thank you, Reynaldo. Speaker Pelosi referenced national security in her remarks last night, saying that this is about ensuring our national security. And as you said, Mike, a lot of this will come out in the upcoming hearings, but we do know that Vladimir Putin seeks to destabilize Western democracies, that he has meddled in Ukraine's affairs, is encroaching on Ukraine. How does that all factor in?
I certainly think it's something that you can't ignore. This isn't a small African country that is off the radar. This isn't a small island nation in the South Pacific. This is a country that the Russians have moved in and taken Crimea from them. This is a country that is large, as the caller alluded to, had large stockpiles of nuclear weapons for a very long time. They are a nascent democracy, and theoretically, America has been supportive of democracies, particularly around large foreign powers that are large dictatorships, like this Russian country is. And the idea that that Ukraine is involved in this yet again has to be more than coincidental, one would think.
We'll continue to follow it. In the meantime, always appreciate your remarks, especially on short notice. So thanks for being here, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Binder runs UNF's political polling operation and teaches political science there. Well, in other news this morning, Florida is looking to cut its budget for some of the state's most vulnerable disabled citizens. State leaders are proposing changes to a Medicaid program that serves the disabled in order to save money. Advocates, though, say the funding cuts could end up costing the state even more in the long run. At the same time, families are speaking out about problems they've had for years with Florida's Medicaid waiver program. Some families have waited over a decade to get their kids help. In some cases, kids have died waiting. Here with more, Dr. Chris Scabbard. He's English professor at UNF and author of A Life Beyond Reason. It's a memoir about his late son, August, who spent 5 years on Florida's Medicaid waiting list. Good morning, Dr. Gabbard.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you. Also joining us in studio is Debbie Heaton. She's the adoptive parent of many kids with complex medical, developmental disabilities, and her kids have been on this Medicaid wait list for years. One of them passed away while waiting. Debbie, good morning, and I'm sorry for your loss.
Good morning to you.
And if you want to hear more about issues with Florida's Medicaid waiver program, listen up and give us a call. Have you had trouble getting services for your disabled child? We want to hear from you. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Chris Gabbard, let's begin with you. Your son, August, passed away in 2013. He had significant multiple impairments. You didn't have a whole lot of trouble getting help for him in California through their program. When you moved to Florida, you were told you'd have to wait at least 10 years to receive the Medicaid waiver. And so you were thrust into this maelstrom that thousands of Florida families have, being put on a long waiting list. What impact did that have on your family?
It had a huge impact. Let me say two things before I answer your question. One is, if you people have the time to go to a Miami Herald article published yesterday, the title is Medicaid is Lifeline, but Medicaid Waiver is Life. And that is so absolutely true, because oftentimes it's a matter of life and death whether you get the waiver. Some people actually 100% absolutely depend on the waiver in order to maintain their lives. The other thing I want to mention is that when we moved here from California to Florida in 2001, we had what's called the Medi-Cal waiver in California, the equivalent. And I naively assumed that would follow us to Florida when I accepted a job, a tenure track position at the University of North Florida. I had no idea that we would then have to start again with Florida and apply. And then we were told at the very beginning we have at least a 10-year wait before we could receive waiver, the waiver benefits.
You finally did get the Medicaid waiver for your son. And let's explain what the Medicaid waiver is.
Medicaid waiver basically, in actuality, allows the income of the child, often a child who has medically complex conditions, to have their income waived as consideration for benefits for Medicaid. In other words, they can have access to Medicaid services. So the family's income is not taken into consideration. And it's not just kids with very mild disabilities. These are kids who are chronic conditions that are complex, often profoundly physically and or mentally disabled, as was the case with my son. And so the needs for taking care of a child like that are just tremendous. And the impact on the family is huge. People often don't really comprehend how much of an impact on the family having a severely disabled child is, in terms of you can't earn a living in the way that you ordinarily would. You have a tremendous burden in terms of medical bills and also therapies and treatment and often 24/7 care. You can't take a child with a complex medical condition to your typical daycare center. The only daycare center in Florida, in Jacksonville, that services this population is the DLC Nurse and Learn, of which I've become a member of the board of directors. I want to put a plug in for them, because it's the only place that'll accept kids with significant disabilities and or medical needs. Otherwise, you have no place to take your child. And so that puts an incredible burden on families.
In a moment, we'll talk about proposed changes to this program that have families quite alarmed in Florida. And we want to hear from you about Florida's Medicaid waiver program. If you have questions, call us up at 549-2937. Now, about 35,000 people in the state receive Medicaid waiver services. 22,000 who've applied don't. That's nearly 40% of applicants on the wait list not getting services, and that wait can go on for many years. Debbie Heaton, let's talk about your family. You've had kids on the list for years, and you lost a child while waiting. What happened in your family?
It is a very long wait sometimes to get on the waiver. The needs are so immense, and you have children with serious complex issues. You have Medicaid, but Medicaid only covers the medical aspect. When you need in-home care or just a respite service, it is so difficult to find anyone that can help you. The Med waiver is supposed to be there to help families with these needs, and most oftentimes you're on a wait list that never ends.
And so that's what you experienced. How many kids do you have, and how many of them were on the list?
So I have 6 children at home right now.
Wow. You're busy, to say the least.
And most of them are seriously complex. I am blessed that I am able to take care of them. But there is also the times when, you know, if I had Med waiver to assist with the care with someone that could come in and give respite services, it would surely make a difference. And there are some families that have to work outside the home. And when you have to work outside the home and there is no daycare and, you know, the child is sick, then you're stranded.
That's right. And this is thousands of families in this situation. We spoke about this recently with Dr. Elizabeth Perkins. She's associate director and research associate professor at the Florida Center for Inclusive Communities. Perkins directs the Florida DD waitlist campaign to try to call attention to this problem. Here's Perkins.
About 35,000 people receive Medicaid waiver services. About 21,000, 22,000 do not. And this is the issue, is that basically we have a service where 38% of people that have applied are not receiving the services. And that the wait list for many people can go on for years, even in some cases, 10, 15 years or so. It's very troubling because we have a situation where there's been money from the Agency for Persons with Disabilities that has gone towards the wait list over several years, but it's never been any more than to sort of really address the growth and needs of people and the population that we have.
So as the need is growing, changes are now being proposed, Chris, that have families like yours alarmed. Florida's Agency for Persons with Disabilities is suggesting several changes to the Medicaid waiver program. It's called iBudget. These changes, critics say, could be the first step to moving this program into the managed care system. Private companies essentially running the state's Medicaid program, correct?
Yes, that is the fear that it'll become privatized. But one thing to consider is that, you know, Florida spends $1.4 billion legislatively for people with disabilities in the state. That sounds like a lot of money. But actually, when it comes to state rankings, Florida is 49th of the 50 states in terms of the amount of money it allocates for people, children, and adults with disabilities. Well, the only state we're ahead of is Nevada, or we're behind Mississippi and Alabama and Texas. This means basically that we are way down in the rankings in terms of just how much is being allotted. And the legislature is trying to cut back on, they're telling basically the Agency for Persons with Disabilities to cut the budget somehow because they become frustrated with what they perceive to be deficit spending and irregularities. The real problem is that the legislators have not really come to terms with how much it actually costs to take care of a person who has a very compromised physical condition or mental condition.
So in other words, families like yours and activists around this issue believe that the proposed cuts could end up being more expensive in the long
run? Oh yes, because basically it costs the state about $150,000 per person who's disabled if you put them in a long-term care facility. It costs the state $35,000 to allot money to families to take care of that member within their own household. What they're doing is they're depending on families basically to take more and more of a hit on the assumption that their emotional ties to their family member will be such that they will not put their family member into a long-term care facility. I know from my situation that there's a certain breaking point where we would have had to surrender our son to a long-term care facility because we have a daughter to take care of also. Mm-hmm. We would have been forced into the situation of having to choose between which child will we take care of.
Sophie's choice, in
other
words. It'll
be a Sophie's choice. This is what I think the legislators are gambling on, that parents will not make that choice. But you can push families to the brink where they have no choice, but they do have to surrender their child, and then it'll be much more costly to the state.
Debbie, are you in that situation?
I'm in that same loop.
What are you going to do? What are your choices?
Well, the choices are beg for services. Oftentimes, when you contact the Agency for Disabilities, you have to go through a criteria checklist. And if you're not actually indigent or without a place to live, you cannot get services. You will remain on that waiting list for a very, very long time.
Here's an email from Joe. My son has been waiting over 15 years, as have many others. What a joke. Shame on the Florida legislature for being one of the weakest providers with respect to this program. Many have just given up.
Not just given up, they've fled the state. Medical refugees is an issue in Florida. People are leaving, and I know of several families that had to leave because they could not find services in Florida. There are other states that are much more bountiful. South Carolina is a much better place to be. There's a number of states, and not necessarily a north, south, or east, west divide. Some states like Rhode Island are poor in their services. New York is actually cutting back pretty severely. California is not a bad place to be. Nevada is awful. Kentucky is not too bad. It's actually better to be in Kentucky. It's actually better to be in Arkansas than it is to be in Florida.
And this is a relatively small population, but it's an incredibly vulnerable population. And so how challenging has it been to get this message out, given that We're talking about around 50,000 families. Is that about right, that are in this pool?
Well, at 35 and 22, I majored in English, so I can't do the math. But that's not an inconsequential number. The problem is that our families do not have lobbyists. They don't have a super PAC. They don't have time. They're strapped in their homes because they're frantically trying to take care of their chronically ill or chronically disabled person. For example, one person who's going to be here this morning could make it in because she told me in an email last night her son came home vomiting and had a fever, and she doesn't have respite care, so she couldn't make it to the studio. This is so frequently the case that why the public doesn't know more about the plight of these families is because they're often so overworked and overtaxed with what they have to do that they can't make their cases public.
Debbie, tell me about the child you lost while waiting for services for the state's Medicaid waiver program. What was the child's name? What was their condition? What happened? Tell me about the child.
Sarah Joy was a severely complex microcephalic cerebral palsy, a beautiful little girl that contracted pneumonia and passed away in the hospital last Christmas. We had applied for services for agency with persons with disabilities for the Med waiver, and of course were placed on the waiting list. I asked at one time, could we get extra services for her, just respite services, just someone to come to the house so that they could help with bathing and just give us a break to be able to go to the store. And the advice or the comment from them was after you did your complete application was that they had nothing to offer, that Sarah Joy would have to have either no place to live, no family to care for her, or place her in a long-term care facility. That was the only way they could offer services.
And you were, as her mom, basically caring for her around the clock.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
And so we're talking about kids that basically need round-the-clock care. And for parents who have to work, make a living, this becomes incredibly difficult.
We feared losing the house. We came close to bankruptcy, taking care of our son, August. Now, fortunately, we had the intercession of State Senator Stephen Weiss. My wife kept pestering local officials for years, actually. And finally, a staffer in his office called back, got my wife's story. We weren't in a crisis situation. How we came off the wait list is really a miracle. It's really unusual. It doesn't happen for 99% of the cases. But we were blessed to have the senator intercede for us. That was in 2005. This is really before iBudget days. iBudget did not come into being until July 1st, 2013. We were on something called CDC Plus, and that was the only thing available at the time when we had access to the waiver. But we spent 5 years on the waiver, in which case we incurred tremendous medical bills for our son. And we very nearly went bankrupt. I had heart palpitations. I remember having this incredible amount of stress about whether we'd be able to keep the family in our house because the medical bills were overwhelming us.
So only the most determined families with connections, it sounds like, can make their way through this process.
My wife and I are educated people. And I guess we knew how to pull strings. And in our one case, and it doesn't happen even, I know other educated people who've done the same thing and were unsuccessful. For some reason, it worked for us, but one particular person heard our plea. But we have not forgotten all those other families whose pleas are not being heard. And that's why I'm here today.
And Chris, all those other families that are single parent families that don't have anybody else to rely on. Fortunately, you had mom and dad to help with your son. There's other families that have no one and they have no daycare and their income is so limited that they can't work outside the house when the child is ill. They can't get extra services when they need it. There are, we have to think of those single parent families also that can't get any services.
So what's your message then to Tallahassee, the legislature? They will be convening again in early 2020. This program will be reviewed. What is your hope for the outcome?
My hope is that they will reduce this waiting list, that they will come up with another way to find funds for services for the severely needed children of our state.
I would like to see the legislature make a multi-year commitment to reducing the number of the people on the waiting list and also to stop talking about cutting allocations, because that is not the way it should be going. The allocations already are insufficient. As I said, we're 49th out of 50 states in terms of allocations for people born with disabilities. That is just unconscionable.
Have you met with the local legislative delegation?
Not yet, but I will, because I'm just sort of waking up to this myself. I have to say, my son passed away in 2013, and it lay dormant in my mind for a number of years, and now it's coming back to my consciousness. This is something I want to do and devote myself to.
Well, we appreciate you shining a light on this. As you said, the Miami Herald and other media outlets around the state have been talking about this in recent weeks, and it's an issue for thousands of Florida families. Thank you so much, Chris Gabbard, Debbie Heaton, sharing the stories of your children and proposed changes to Florida's Medicaid waiver program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
A quick break, and up next, regenerative agriculture is taking off in Florida. We'll tell you why. That's in our Going Green. But first, here's how you can support WJCT.
Hi, I'm Kelsey Snell. I cover Congress for NPR. With so much information at your disposal, finding a news source you trust can be tricky, like bobbing for apples. Listening to public radio, on the other hand, is much easier, like going apple picking. When you listen to public radio, you know you're getting reliable, fact-based news backed by listeners just like you. Here's how you can help grow our network of journalists today.
Call 353-9528 right now to support public radio in Jacksonville. And let me repeat that number, 353-9528 is the number you should call to support First Coast Connect. What an extraordinary program this morning, as it is every morning, from politics to life. That's what we cover here. We also bring you all the national and international news all day long with programs like Morning Edition, Here and Now, and All Things Considered, and Fresh Air, and all the great programs in between. But it costs about $500,000 a year just to program the radio station. So if you will give us a little bit of your hard-earned money to help us keep this programming coming your way, we would say thank you so much. We're just below $9,000 towards an $80,000 goal, and we don't have a lot of time to get there. So we hope you will take the time to give us a call at 353-9528. Whether it's the music at night you like or old-time radio on Sunday nights, news and information all day long, some fun shows on the weekend. This is your public radio station, and without your contributions, it's hard to make the bills. So won't you take the time now to make that phone call, 353-9528 or 1-800-722-9528. Or, of course, you can join us anytime at all online at wjct.org and look for the support or donate button. It's important you give us a call because we just come to you twice a year and ask for your help. And if you're not giving us the help, it's hard to pay the bills. You like the programming? We hope you will take the time to show your appreciation. We've got an Echo Dot giveaway every day, the Amazon Dot. So you will be in the drawing if you give us a call now for just today's people. So you're not going to be in there with hundreds of people. You got a good chance of winning an Amazon Echo Dot if you will call us at 353-9528. It's just one way we say thank you. We've also got an insulated tote bag and a stainless steel straw. But the real thing we give you every day is the programming. So if you like the programming, you appreciate what we do here every day, then we hope you will take the time to call us right now at 353-9528. And we thank you so much for your support.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Well, it's billed as a solution for two big problems, human health and environmental health. Justin Root is president of Nutritional Roots, a local company, and he's here now to tell us more about regenerative agriculture. It's our Going Green for today. Hey, Justin, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Stoked to be here.
So what is regenerative agriculture?
So regenerative agriculture, as you mentioned, solves two big problems, environmental health and human health. So organic agriculture asks the question, how can we grow all these crops without adding toxins and carcinogens, the pesticides, herbicides, fungicides? Regenerative agriculture goes a step beyond that and says, how can we mimic what nature does so we can give back to the local environment? And what that comes down to is taking care of the health of the soil. The soil should be a living ecosystem. In a square inch of soil, there are over 4 billion organisms. So when you take care of that soil, it does a lot of things for the environment, and it also produces more nutrient-dense crops for people.
So how do you do regenerative agriculture then? How does it work?
So it's based on mimicking the cycles in nature. Nature has a lot of regenerative qualities to it, so you want to take advantage of that. So you focus more on perennial crops than annual crops, a lot of biodiversity, And you apply those different principles so that you're kind of mimicking what nature would do by itself, and you're producing a better yield with your crops by doing those types of things.
This is important in our era of climate change because it has a positive impact on reducing carbon emissions, right?
Absolutely. It's a great way to sequester carbon. I mean, our food system right now produces 30% of our greenhouse gases. So if we can become more efficient and economical with the way we're growing our crops and improving our yield, we have an opportunity to take the carbon balance and restore it. So we're moving carbon from the atmosphere back down into the earth where it belongs.
And it makes for healthier food too,
yes,
which is
exactly.
Good.
A lot of people don't realize that there's less micronutrients in our food than there were 20, 30, 40 years ago. So by improving the vitality of the soil, by bringing the carbon back down into the earth, you're going to restore the nutrient density in those crops.
How did you get onto this path?
So in my mid-20s, I went for a physical, tipped the scale at 260 pounds, had hypertension. The doctor told me I would need blood pressure medicine the rest of my life. I decided a pill wasn't something I wanted to depend on for the next 40, 50 years and decided to lose weight instead. Found it incredibly challenging. There's so much conflicting information out there, so much disagreement. And I just, you know, I have a huge appetite for food, but I also have a huge appetite for learning. And I just kind of pored over the research, and I went from what was on my plate to what was on the shelf in the grocery store, all the way down to the seed, getting certified in permaculture design out in Missouri. And that's where I discovered regenerative agriculture, and my personal problem just became a professional passion with nutritional roots.
And you turned it into a company.
That's what we did. I teamed up with a doctor out of Cleveland, Ohio, who's been helping his patients with plant-based nutrition for the last 10 years. And as we build out this company, it's become important to me to look for regenerative farmers as we source our ingredients.
You make hemp CBD oil, so you are right in the middle of the CBD craze.
It is a wild world out there, yes.
Tell us about the hemp business and how you see that happening in Florida, because it has been kind of called the Wild Wild West. As a business owner, how are you dealing with that?
So we're staying on, I mean, on a federal level, the Farm Bill opened it up, created this kind of world, this big broad market, and then each state has been adopting different policies. Florida's still in the process of creating their policies. I just got an update on Friday. And so we're staying on top of what each state is doing and how each state is going to handling it. When we made this product, it was a great opportunity to embrace this regenerative agriculture because cannabis is a crop that responds really well to this type of practice. So we found a farmer who's been actually a vegetable farmer for the last decade using these principles. And she was experimenting with hemp and cannabis and using the same principles. And we're really stoked to team up with her to bring this product to market.
And your hemp is grown out of state though, right?
Yeah. We grow our hemp up in the Green Mountains of Vermont. They've been at the cutting edge of it on the East Coast, cannabis and hemp growth. So we wanted to go with people who have the most experience.
But people can buy the CBD oil right here in Jacksonville. Do they buy it online from you?
You can find it at nutritionalroots.com. Would be the best place to find it. And we're also looking to pair up with some local retailers to carry it as well.
You're part of a real movement in this area for encouraging local, sustainable agriculture, and now regenerative agriculture. Tell us about the movement locally and what you see happening.
So I was really impressed as we started to source ingredients, and I wanted to work locally with as many farmers as possible. There are a lot of folks around here that have been embracing these principles quietly on their farms and not really sharing it with consumers. So you got a farm out here called Eat Your Yard, which they do a lot of educational events. I think it's only a couple acres. You can find them at RAM. But they're really smart about how they're going about growing their crops. And so I just really wanted to call attention to that, because when you're out at these farmers markets, if you're just asking these farmers a few simple questions, you can find the right farmers to support, the ones who are doing it right.
For farmers that are still farming the traditional way using pesticides, how do you get them to change? Because when they use chemicals, it's more efficient, it's quicker, it's easier. At least that's been the argument all these years.
Yeah, so that's definitely a huge challenge. And one of their big hesitations is yield. And if you look at the numbers, the Rodale Institute has gathered a lot of research. The yield is actually better when you really embrace these regenerative agriculture principles. The challenge is, when the organic movement started, They were taking conventional practices and just trying to just not use toxic chemicals, and the yield suffered in that case. But if you totally adopt these regenerative and organic principles of biodiversity, perennials, water retention, all those little details, it actually improves the yield. And you're using less amendments, so it's less expensive for the farmer. They don't have to buy all the pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and they get more product out of their efforts.
You are encouraging people to support businesses that use regenerative ag products, like one in particular is Southern Roots in Riverside. That's an all-vegan restaurant, but there are others.
Yeah, there are. I mean, I love what they're doing at the Southern Roots filling station. Delicious food, and they were very careful about their sourcing. Grassroots is another great one over in Riverside. They carry a lot of produce from these types of farms. Frog Song Organic, it's a little bit south of here. They create a lot of delicious produce using these principles, and they're often carried at Grassroots, so that's another great one. And then Nutritional Roots, too, if you want some.
Your company.
Yeah.
What about people that are interested in growing their own groceries, at least experimenting with it, trying to start a vegetable garden at home?
I think that's a great way to get involved in this and kind of help move the movement forward. If you look back at World War II, World War I, victory gardens were a very common thing. And at one point, they were producing 40% of our produce in the United States. So there's a lot of potential to grow your own groceries. There's a gentleman around town named the Man in Overalls. If you Google him, Nathan, he specializes in helping people set up these little gardens in their backyard for produce. And what's great about regenerative agriculture, you're mimicking an ecosystem, right? So it at some point becomes a cycle where it really doesn't need as many inputs and a lot of attention like gardening, like you think it would.
The Man in Overalls was kind enough to give me some soil to get started on my own little patch.
Oh, yeah, that's good stuff.
And it was great. And, you know, we planted lettuce and carrots and onions and everything was going great.
Yeah.
And then a raccoon came one night in the middle of the city.
They need you too.
And they ate it all. They ate it all, Justin. And I had no more vegetable garden. I was so upset. I couldn't believe it. I thought, we moved, you know, into the urban core and I've still got a raccoon coming in and eating my vegetables.
Yeah.
So I've got to figure out something different to keep the coons out.
Some fencing or something. I'm sure Nathan has techniques for you to help you with that, but that definitely is a challenge.
It was terrible because they were almost done, you know? So there went the garden, but I'm going to try again.
Absolutely. I encourage everyone in Jacksonville to give it a try because it's a lot of fun.
You can go to permies.com for that. And so what are your final thoughts about this movement and what it means for Florida agriculture? Because, you know, one of the big legs of Florida's economic stool is agriculture.
Absolutely. And I think Jacksonville locally, what's going on with the river, the way it's rising, the toxicity in the river. And I also think about the amount of space we have here in Jacksonville, you know, the biggest city in the continental U.S. There's a tremendous opportunity to be using that land responsibly and sustainably and going back to our agrarian roots here in Jacksonville. And in doing so, we can help improve the local health of our environment and create more food for people that need it.
Well, Justin Root, it is great to have you on. Go to his website, nutritionalroots.com, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
In a moment, we've got a ticket giveaway. You're going to have to keep listening to find out to what. We'll be right back. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Keep listening.
I'm Courtney Lewis, music director of the Jacksonville Symphony. This season, we're celebrating the 250th birthday of perhaps the most transformative composer in all of music history, Ludwig van Beethoven. We're beginning our Masterworks season with his unique symphony, The Pastoral. Beethoven said, "No one can love the country as I do," and the beautiful Pastoral Symphony provides the proof. Join us October 4th and 5th. Tickets and more at jackssymphony.org.
Thank you. I'm Jeremy Hobson. One of the world leaders in New York for the UN General Assembly is NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. We'll talk with him about Iran, Afghanistan, and the importance of NATO.
NATO is important for the United States. The strength of a nation can be measured not only on the size of its economy, the number of its soldiers, but also by the number of its friends.
That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 here on 89.9 WJCT.
The House has officially begun an impeachment inquiry, and the two parties have staked out their positions.
The president must be held accountable. No one is above the law.
Our job is to legislate, not to continue to investigate something in the back when you cannot find any reason to impeach this president.
Is this a new chapter in the Trump presidency? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
When baby makes three, is that one too many? Some are convinced that overpopulation lies at the heart of the climate crisis. America's birth rate is down, but families in poorer countries are having more children. How much would having smaller families reduce our carbon footprint? Our series, No Plan B, continues next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, they are the only agency helping homeless adults in the Jacksonville Beaches area. Mission House is having a big soiree this week, Compassion by the Sea. Lori Delgado Anderson is executive director at Mission House, Inc. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks for being with us. You're working to help raise money. It's the only agency at the beaches helping people living on the streets. And so this is coming up Thursday night. Tell us about it.
It's going to be a lot of fun. It's at Three Palms Grill in Ponte Vedra. Beautiful site. We have the best band in town, Cloud Nine. We have heavy appetizers, complimentary wine and beer, a fabulous silent auction, some great trips, and it's going to be a lot of fun. Brian Sexton is our MC.
Very nice, from the Jaguars. And this is so timely because you've seen a spike in homelessness at the beaches, correct?
Well, actually, we have seen a decrease this year, but we have seen an increase in engagement with our folks who come to see us. So more people are seeing our case managers and having services and getting housed. So this year we have a 15% increase of people that we have housed into permanent safe housing. It's 98 people this year, and we housed 114 men and women last year.
In this movement, finally, people are coming around to the simple concept that to reduce homelessness, you need to provide homeless people housing.
Exactly. And that's our biggest challenge, finding apartments that will work with us. Once they know that Mission House will be giving the first month's rent, they feel a little more comfortable. And we also don't just house someone and leave them. We follow them for 12 months. We make sure they're successful. We do everything we can. They do the interviews. They find the apartment. But we walk with them to make sure if there's anything that comes up, we'll take care of it.
Now, you need volunteers for what you're doing as well. Tell us about that.
Yes, we have about 600 volunteers that work with us doing our day-to-day operations, but we always need more. The most need right now, we have a free clinic that a lot of people don't know about, and we are always in need of licensed doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and we even need people who are not clinically savvy, but they know the computer. And we need a lot of help with finding free medications and doing things in the clinic that are non-clinical.
If you want to help Mission House, go to their website, missionhousejax.org, and buy some tickets for the big party tomorrow night. What else can people hear about the party? The soiree, I should say.
The soiree, yes. Just the food is fantastic at Three Palms. It's a great site, and it'll be a lot of fun. Great dancing and good food.
That's Compassion by the Sea tomorrow night at Three Palms Grill in Ponte Vedra to help the homeless at the beaches. Lori Delgado Anderson is executive director at Mission House. That website again is missionhousejax.org. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
Okay, that's tomorrow night. And finally this hour, what you've been waiting for, a ticket giveaway. Yes, we've got some tickets to give away right now to the Jacksonville Home and Patio Show. Spokeswoman Liz Morgan is here with those. You've got the hot tickets in your hand.
That's right. In my hot little hands, I have tickets to one of the largest consumer events. It comes around twice a year. And tomorrow starts 4 days of the fall edition. As always, there's always something new. One of the things that you'll see this year, we always have a celebrity guest, and this year it's the Bennetts. They're a couple from HGTV's Desert Flippers, and they work out in Palm Springs, but that is a remarkably similar in style to Jacksonville, and they're going to be talking about renovation, DIY, and also what we have is the Skilled Trade Resource Center. There's a real issue facing the industry in that there's a lack of skilled trade workers coming up. You know, the older generation is aging out. And so the industry is in desperate need of HVAC, plumbers, contractors. And there's a whole resource center that's going to be at the show. They offer scholarships. They're offering paid apprenticeships. You're going to be able to learn about that. And that's something new this year as we're trying to address that issue.
That's a good opportunity for folks. Okay, so how many pairs of tickets do we have here, Liz?
We have five.
Five pairs.
Five pairs of tickets.
Wow. So email the show right now if you want a free pair of tickets to check out the Jacksonville Home and Patio Show this weekend at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. We will pick five winners at random. And to get the tickets, what you have to do is, do they have to come here to the station for them, or can they present at will call?
We're going to leave them at will call.
You're going to leave them at will call. We will put your name at the will call counter. So email us now at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org to win a free pair of tickets to the Jacksonville Home and
Patio
Show. That's
right. They're good for any day of the show.
You are the best, Liz Morgan.
Well, right back at you, Melissa.
Thanks for being here. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. Bill Bortsfield is the station's digital editor. We always want your feedback. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, Florida residents deciding to leave the U.S. What is driving the spike in expatriates? That's tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And if you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for some great music. If you're with us this morning, here's how you can support WJCT.
I'm Rebecca Hersher. Earlier this year, NPR analyzed more than 40,000 records from FEMA and found that some disaster aid was going disproportionately to white communities. Poorer people and people of color often don't get the money they need to rebuild. Now, the Government Accountability Office says they will investigate the disparity. Investigative journalism makes a difference. Here's how you can support it.
Call 353-9528 right now to support public radio in Jacksonville.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.